In this lecture, I want to go back to that period of ferment in the 6th century BC and look at two figures, Mahavira and the Buddha, who were very important in the extended religious life of that period. Mahavira the Tirthankara, as he's called, the Ford Maker, whose influence continues today in the Jain tradition, and the Buddha, whose presence is still felt in India and indeed around the world, in the Buddhist religious tradition. Both of these figures, Mahavira and the Buddha, have diverged enough from the broad fabric of Hindu religious tradition to be seen in a sense as separate streams in that tradition. And both are particularly strong and bright strands of the fabric of Indian religious society. In Delhi, today, across from the Red Fort in the old part of Delhi, there's a very interesting institution. It's a bird hospital that is run by the Jains. In that part of Delhi, pigeons are legion, and they are the principal admittees to this hospital. They have broken legs and broken wings, and the first and second floor of the hospital are enclosed wards for those birds that need intensive care. And the wards at the top of the hospital are open to the sky so that when a bird is well enough to fly away, he can fly off. Throughout India, there are hospices made by the Jain tradition for cattle and for other animals as well. Animal shelters. What about people, you might ask? Well, of course, the Jains maintain hospitals for people, too. But the interesting question is, what understanding of life animates a tradition which maintains hospitals not only for people, but also for birds, and in which the ideal models of religious life, the Jain monks and nuns, travel with a small company of whisk brooms and brushes, which they handle as deftly as they do their own limbs, to whisk off the places where they sit so that they don't unwittingly crush any small microscopic forms of life. What kind of tradition is this? From the 7th century BCE to the present, the Jains have contributed a distinctive view of life, of karma, and of nonviolence to the Indian tradition. As for the Buddha, we begin to see his influence as a distinctive set of colors, you might say, in the fabric of India in the generations following the life of the Buddha in the 6th century BCE. It remains a strong influence in that fabric for some time, woven in various ways into the fabric of Indian religious life. And then for a time, with the beginning of the Muslim period in about the 11th century, 12th century, disappears for a while, at least in such a vibrant form, then reappears especially in this century with the return of Buddhists to some of the holy sites of India, especially in the late 19th century with the Buddhist reformer Anagarika Dharmapala from Sri Lanka, who went back to Bodh Gaya, the site of the Buddha's enlightenment, and reclaimed that site as a place of pilgrimage for Buddhists. And the conversion of a great many untouchables to Buddhism in this century in India under the influence of the political leader B.R. Ambedkar. And then, of course, the well-known return of the Dalai Lama to India as a refugee, having fled from Tibet in the 1950s, and the development of an entire Tibetan Buddhist tradition in exile, refugee people in India, in a set of institutions that has been very influential in stimulating the life of Buddhist India. So we have these two figures, Mahavira and the Buddha. I want to compare them for a moment and then look at each of them and their traditions separately. Both of these teachers were part of this atmosphere of inquiry, of ferment, of seeking in the 6th century BCE that we associate last time with the seekers of the Upanishads. Mahavira was the somewhat older contemporary of the Buddha. According to traditional dates, the Buddha's dates were 563 to 483 BCE and Mahavira 599 to 527 BCE. But both basically participated in this era of searching and change with various other teachers, yogis, preachers, ascetics, various types of religious thinkers and practitioners. Many were called shramanas, a word which really means strivers, those who exerted themselves in the spiritual search. They were ascetics. They were nonconformist. They were not part of the social stratification, you might say. They were not doers of ritual. They were not satisfied participants in the social life of villages. They were ascetics, homeless wanderers. Some of them rejected the authority of the Vedas and its Brahmanical priesthood. The Buddhists and Jains were among the most successful, you might say, heterodox groups in ancient India, among these shramanas. And both of them launched traditions that have remained vibrant for, well, now over 2,600 years. Both Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha, and Vardhamana, who became Mahavira, were kshatriyas, as were many of the other seekers of the time. Both were teachers who eventually emphasized realization or salvation or enlightenment, however one wants to speak of it, by our own human striving and strength and discipline. They were themselves not divine descents, not avatars, but preached a doctrine of being lamps unto yourselves, as the Buddha put it. There's no God who's going to reach down to help you, no sacrifice which is going to carry you over there on its frail boat, no revealed wisdom that is going to save you, but be lamps unto yourselves. Kindle that inner light within you. Let it shine forth. Both of them were critical of the ritual of the yajna. Both of them denied, in a sense, the authority, the revealed status of the Veda, a Shruti. They were, in that sense, called Gnosticas, no-sayers in the tradition. Neither was individualistic. Both of them had monastic orders. Both also had lay followers. And there was a somewhat closer integration of laity and monks in the Jain tradition, so that the monastic orders would travel homeless, moving from place to place throughout most of the year. But during the rainy season, they would stay in one place during those 4 months, the summer months, when the rains came. It was too difficult to move around. That was true for both the Buddhists and the Jains. The Jains tended to stay with the laity in their homes. And the Buddhists tended more prominently to have monasteries built by the laity, by wealthy patrons at the edge of some of the cities. But one of the reasons that some have speculated that the Buddhists died out in India, whereas the Jains continued more vibrantly persistently in small numbers, but even to today, was precisely that there were no monasteries to be destroyed, as the great monasteries and educational institutions of Buddhist India were by the Muslim invaders in the 11th and 12th centuries. Institutions like the University of Nalanda in what is today Bihar, one of the great Buddhist universities of the world. But everything was there, and so it was pretty easy to destroy it. It's very hard to have destroyed so simply this life of a Jain monastic and lay follower that was so well integrated, you might say, and which did not have as much those separate institutions. Another commonality is that neither of them is theistic, in the sense that neither the Buddha nor Mahavira spoke too much about the gods who could answer prayers or respond. And in the development of their traditions, neither was supposed to be seen as a god himself. I'll talk a bit more about that later. But, for example, in a Jain temple today, there would be a marble image of a Tirthankara, of a ford maker like Mahavira and some of those who came before him. But though people would offer flowers to that image, perhaps make offerings, there is clearly a sense that there is no spirit in that image to grant favors or to lend a helping hand. I had a very interesting conversation on this matter at a Jain pilgrimage place in Gujarat called Mount Girnar, where I was walking up the path with some Jain women, and they had just been to one of these temples. They had made the offerings before the marble image of the Tirthankara. And I said, well, what benefit do you expect to gain from worshiping and making these offerings? And one of the Jain women said to me, only to make our heart pure. We don't expect God to do anything for us. Rather, we become who we are according to our deeds. We make ourselves. And by these acts of offering, of generosity, of hospitality, of devotion, we purify ourselves. It makes our heart pure. The other thing is that the Jains and Buddhists, in a sense, share some of the same worldview, you might say, of the Upanishads. The perception of this world as samsara, as a course, a passage, a flow, a constant movement and change, the wheel of birth and death and birth, the notion of rebirth, the notion of karma, that the journey from life to life is not arbitrary, but has a kind of causality to it, that there is justice, so to speak, though we do not see it in the single frame of this life, perhaps, that acts have their consequences in life after life. Now, let me turn for a few moments, especially to Mahavira and the Jain tradition. Mahavira, they say, was the last in a line of Jain Tirthankaras, or ford makers, many of them lost in ancient time of legend. He was said to be the 24th of them, but the 23rd, a teacher named Parshvanatha, is said to have lived two centuries before Mahavira in about the 9th century BCE, and the 22nd is said to have been a contemporary of Lord Krishna, which places him even further back in time, though we can't say exactly what time that was. In any case, then the lineage of these ford makers extends way back into the realms of ancient, ancient history. Mahavira was born with the name Vardhamana some 30 years before the time of the Buddha. He was born in the city of Vaishali near modern Patna in Bihar in North India. He was a Kshatriya from the royal ranks, you might say, educated, married, apparently had a daughter according to tradition. And at the age of 28, his parents died, and he turned over his affairs, presumably including responsibility for his wife and his daughter, to an elder brother and renounced the world. He plucked out all of his hair, as Jain monks and nuns do even to this day in the act of becoming a monk or a nun, and went off to practice asceticism. He wore a single garment for 1 year, it is said, and then he cast even that garment aside and went completely sky-clad, as they said, or naked. He lived a life of severe ascesis, begging alms, sitting in meditation for 12 years, or for 6 months standing utterly motionless without eating, burning away the last of the karma that accrued to his being, and attaining the state that Jains refer to as kaivalya, which means isolation or total integration of the immortal soul, the jiva. And then finally, at the attaining of this majestic aloofness, as one writer has referred to it, of the perfected, he began to teach. And Mahavira taught for about 42 years, spending the rainy seasons on the outskirts of some of the great cities of North India, and attained his final liberation, his final nirvana, and they use that word as well, at the age of 72, in a time-honored way in the Jain tradition, non-violently. By self-starvation, he finally, when the time had come, let this body go. Now, if you ask, what is the understanding of the world, of the soul, of liberation that underlies this tradition that keeps hospitals for birds and honors heroes who have stood still for periods so long that the vines begin to grow up their legs? It is a very distinctive view of the soul. Distinctive from the Upanishadic view, in that the Jain view, there is no ultimate reality out there somewhere, whatever it's called, Brahman, across which time and space is woven, warp and woof, what is real is what is called the jiva, J-I-V-A, which means literally a life. And the jiva is not undifferentiated, not limitless spirit or soul, but the individual living life of each of us. Each of us is or has within us a jiva, so to speak, a life monad, it's sometimes called, simply to suggest that this is an individuated soul that is within each of us. The jiva in its pure state is said to be utterly luminous and omniscient, but it is obscured by an overlay of karma. It is entangled in matter. And karma has almost a materialistic flavor in this tradition. In order for the jiva, therefore, to attain its true nature, to exist in freedom and bliss and luminosity, the incrustation of matter needs to be shattered. Not only is it the case that the soul is an ontological reality, a tattva it's called, but the spectrum of life in which these jivas exist is vast. All beings have a soul, not just humans, not just the deer and the elephant, but the bush and the potato, the stone and the drop of water. And the classification of the world is therefore not into mammals and reptiles and fishes and plants, but into individual jivas, each of which has that potential for omniscience. Some of them have only one sense by virtue of the life form into which they are born, the sense of touch, for example, and this would include trees and turnips and earth in all of its forms. All of them are beings, but stones, too, in this view, would feel the crunch of the foot on top of them. Then there are those with two senses of taste and touch as well, like worms and leeches and crabs, or three senses of taste, touch, and smell, like small insects or moths or blind ants, or four senses, taste, touch, smell, and sight, like larger insects. Or five senses, like animals and human beings and gods in this tradition. Gods being seen as sort of not ultimate, but a lesser grade of spirits or beings in this cosmology. And each of these jivas is entangled, in a sense, in a subtle form of matter, karma, which is seen as kind of a stain upon this luminous soul. And every action pours a certain amount of stain upon the soul. Karma means not only action, but an act and all of its implications for us. We never get away with anything, so to speak. The point of the ascetic, therefore, is to practice only the sort of action that does not touch the soul with that kind of stain of karma. That means to stop the influx of karma upon the soul, and gradually, therefore, by asceticism, to clean off what's already there. And the practice of virtue, like truth-telling or non-harming, ahimsa, etc., stops the inflow, and the practice of asceticism begins to scrub off what's already there. I hope I haven't simplified this too much. But there's a remarkable sense here of the sanctity of virtually every form of life. And I want to read you just a piece of a text that gives a sense of this. It's from a story of a prince who sees an ascetic from a palace window, an ascetic who is practicing penance and is full of virtues. And this prince begins to remember a previous life as an ascetic and decides that he wants to renounce the world and again become a shramana. And his parents, of course, try to dissuade him, but the prince responds by telling about all of his previous births in various states of being. And we see in the speech of the prince a particular Jain sensitivity to all the various forms of life as part of a living continuity, a living community of beings, you might say. something that we don't ordinarily think of, things that we really don't imagine sharing the life spectrum with us. Trees, for example, or iron as a metal. And if you want to read some of these texts, actually I'm putting on the bibliography a book called The Sources of Indian Tradition, volume one of it, edited by Ainsley Embry, that has a collection of lots of different writings, but among them some of these writings from the Jains. Here is what the prince says to his parents. From clubs and knives and stakes and maces, breaking my limbs an infinite number of times, I have suffered without hope. By razors and knives and shears, many times have I been drawn and quartered and torn apart and skinned. As an antelope, I have, against my will, been skinned and caught and bound and fastened in snares and traps, frequently killed. As a helpless fish, I've been, against my will, caught with hooks and nets, scraped and slit and killed an infinite number of times. As a bird, I've been caught by hawks and trapped in nets and bound and killed an infinite number of times. As a tree, I have been felled and slit and sawn into planks and stripped of my bark by carpenters with axes and hatchets an infinite number of times. As iron, I've been maleated and cut and torn and filed by blacksmiths an infinite number of times. This is the prince remembering his previous lives. There's much in the Jain tradition that I have not been able to mention in this brief compass, but it's an ancient tradition and a continuing tradition with monks and lay people even today. By now, there are many Jain people in the UK and in the United States, and it's not surprising that the voice of the Jains in the contemporary world has spoken out rather strongly on environmental issues and on animal rights, for example, and has issued a document that I actually have here with me called the Jain Declaration on Nature that came out a few years ago as a Jain contribution to, you might say, the contemporary discussion of environmental issues. And as part of this in the Jain Code of Conduct, they list, for example, kindness to animals, saying, many centuries ago, Jains condemned as evil the common practice of animal sacrifice to the gods. It's generally forbidden to keep animals in captivity, to whip, mutilate, or overload them, to deprive them of adequate food and drink. And it goes on to talk more about animals. It talks about vegetarianism. Except for allowing themselves a judicious use of one-sensed life in the form of vegetables, Jains would not consciously take any life for food or sport. As a community, are strict vegetarians, consuming neither meat, fish, nor eggs, and confining themselves to vegetables and milk products. So you can see that some of these traditions are very much part of a Jain ethos, even today. Now, in the last part of our hour, I want to turn to the life of the Buddha, again to the 6th century BCE, to another Kshatriya or princely family. The one who became known as the Buddha was born in northern India, what is today southern Nepal, the son of a leading citizen, perhaps even a wealthy ruler or prince. His native town was called Kapilavastu, along the foothills of the Himalayas, and it was called also the Kingdom of the Shakyas, and so he became known as the Shakyamuni when he was a holy man, the silent sage of the Shakyas. His name at birth was Siddhartha Gautama, and when he woke up, he became known as the Buddha, the Awakened One. The traditional dates for his life are 563 to 483 BCE, and that life is told in many of the early scriptures called sutras or suttas in Pali, and it was retold centuries later in a remarkable book of the first century of the Common Era, by one Ashvaghosa, who wrote a book called The Acts of the Buddha, or the Buddha Charita, and it tells the story in its completeness, as it is remembered at that time. According to the traditional story of the life of the Buddha, at his birth, astrologers and wise men predicted that this young boy, Siddhartha, would grow up to become a universal king if he remained a householder, but would become fully enlightened if he renounced the world. It's clear that his father preferred the universal monarch option for his son. And according to tradition, the father took pains to see that his son's life would be filled with beauty and with pleasure, so that he would not be tempted by renunciation. But at the age of 29, something happened to Siddhartha, some dramatic confrontation with the fact of human suffering and of human mortality, which decisively changed the course of his life. He was already married. It was shortly after the birth of his first son, a son who was named Rahula, which interestingly means the fetter, so to speak. And when the story came to be told, it was said that the Prince Siddhartha, who had lived all of his life in the shelter of the palace compound, saw on four consecutive pleasure journeys out of the palace four signs which set him to thinking. On his first journey, he saw a very old man. He'd never seen such a thing, and his charioteer explained to him that this person bent and standing on a stick was an old person, that this old age was in fact part of the human condition. And Siddhartha said, "So this is how old age destroys indiscriminately the memory and beauty and strength, and yet with such a sight before it, the world goes on unperturbed?" He was unable to continue that pleasure outing, so disturbed was he by the sight of the old person, and he went back to the palace. On his next excursion, he saw a very sick man. He again had never seen anything quite like it before. He asked his charioteer, "What is this?" Charioteer says, "This is a man who's sick. This is just part of the human condition. People get sick, they get diseases, they die." Again, Siddhartha is astounded that crippling disease so saps a person's strength and beauty. So he turns around. On his third excursion, Siddhartha saw a corpse. "This is the end that has been fixed for all, and yet the world forgets its fears and takes no heed," he said. Again he turned back. And in the days ahead, as he wrestled with his deep distress, he saw his fourth vision, which was a renouncer, a mendicant. Now, the palace of Prince Siddhartha is perhaps not unlike much of modern Western society. We have indeed removed sickness and old age and death from the common daily experience of society. Hospitals, nursing homes, mortuaries all set sickness and aging and death at once remove, you might say, from most people's lives. And many of my students come to college at the age of 20, never having seen anyone who was dead or really confronted at first hand the debilitating effects of illness. The story is arresting because its questions are really deep human questions. What is the meaning of suffering? What is the cause of suffering? And how can we go about our daily lives as if this suffering in the form of aging and sickness and death did not exist? And as if suffering were not one of the most important questions that we have to wrestle with. So he decides to renounce the world. And Ashvaghosa's telling of the tale is very graphic at this point. In the middle of the night, Prince Siddhartha tiptoes into the women's chamber where he sees all the dancing girls of the palace asleep, those women who had been hired part of the palace entourage to provide music and dance and the pleasures of the palace so that he would not be tempted by renunciation. And seeing them asleep, they do not tempt him. In fact, he's filled with a sense of withdrawal and repugnance. They're asleep with their clothes in disarray and their mouths sort of half open and drooling out of the corners of their mouths. And all of this is described in rather vivid detail by Ashvaghosa. Women clearly here, and we have to take note of this when we look at the point of view of this particular text, women are identified with, quote, the world, the worldly, that which is to be renounced and left behind as the hero's spiritual quest is about to begin. And that, of course, is a problem. That's a problem in the Buddhist tradition. It's a problem with many spiritual traditions, as the hero, the spiritual hero, leaves behind the world, and the world often means the women. And the women aren't necessarily seen as the spiritual heroes, but we need to take note of that. In any case, he takes a last look at his wife, his child, asleep in another chamber. He takes his horse and his groom, Chandaka, and he leaves Kapilavastu. And it's interesting that this story of his great renunciation becomes in many ways paradigmatic in the Buddhist tradition. If you were to go to Burma or Thailand today, when a young boy becomes a monk for a period of education, as virtually all of them do, even as a prelude to going to the university or something like that, they'll become a monk for a period of time to learn something about the monastic life. And this great renunciation is repeated almost in ritual form. The boy will leave home with the horse and with all of the ritual paraphernalia of a king in fine clothing, will arrive at the monastery, take all of that and leave it behind, part from his family and take on the orange robes of the monk. And that is a kind of repetition ritually of this great renunciation of Siddhartha. When he took leave of his groomsman, of Chandaka, at the river some distance from town, he said a goodbye that strikes at the very root of human attachment in a way. He said to this close friend of him, his, who had been his attendant for all of his life, birds settle on a tree for a while and then go their separate ways again. The meeting of all living beings must thus end in their parting. Clouds meet and then fly apart again. And in this same way do I see the union of living beings and their parting. Difficult words. Comparing the deepest human attachments, in a sense, to the landing of birds on the same branch for a moment and then flying off their own directions, or the conjuncture of clouds in the sky and their separation. So far, there's little in the paradigmatic tale of the Buddha that's so distinctive. As I said, this is a time of questing and philosophy and seeking, a lot of shramanas, strivers in those forests into which he entered. For 6 years, he is said to have practiced a very severe kind of asceticism, mastering the disciplines of two teachers, taking up a strict diet in which he ate one sesame seed a day, as they put it in the traditional tales, becoming virtually a skeleton. And through his own experimentation, he discovered that this asceticism is not the way. This will not get us anywhere. So he accepts milk and food from a village woman, regains his strength to pursue the spiritual quest anew. At this point, his five companions who had been with him on the journey became disgusted at Siddhartha's lack of perseverance, they say, and they abandon him. And this period of Siddhartha's life is sometimes called the Great Struggle. He is said to have described the ascetic ways as fruitless, like, as he put it, trying to tie the air in knots. The path that Siddhartha ultimately found was his own, not communicated by a teacher or a guru, and that's important here, but found in the depth of his own meditative vision. According to tradition, he thought through, saw through to the very root causes of human suffering, and saw as he unraveled it further and further and looked more and more deeply the very simple truths which can release people from the tangle of sorrow into a life of freedom. The place where he sat as he saw so deeply is called Bodh Gaya, the place of his enlightenment. And this seeing experience is described in highly metaphoric language by the tradition. It was as if, they say, the light suddenly came on in the darkness of his mind, and he saw the clear light of day for the first time ever. It was enlightenment. And they use that term, bodhi, or enlightenment. or it was as if the fuel which had stoked the fires of his attachment and passion, the ego attachment, it is as if that fuel burned all the way down to the end, and there was nothing left. It went out. And the term that is used is nirvana, the going out. And it was as if he had been asleep and suddenly woke up again to gain perspective on the dreams of his sleeping. He became the Buddha, literally the one who is awake. And indeed, when he began to teach, it said that someone approached him on the road, astonished at the luminous quality of Siddhartha's bearing, and said, "Who are you? Are you a god? Are you an angel? Who are you?" And he said, "I am awake." The implication being that most of us, most of the time, are pretty much asleep. I am awake. What he saw in his deep seeing, I'll talk about next time. He spoke of the three marks of existence, that it is dukkha, sorrowful, anitya, impermanent, and anatta, that there is no self inside. But if we ask in the teachings of the Buddha, the deep questions of the Upanishads, what is the permanent substrate beneath all of this? What is the ground of all of this being? The Buddha would basically say, in part, it's precisely because we want so much for there to be a permanent ground underneath everything that we are still in captivity to our own desire, to our own grasping. We want something to hang on to. But it's not the hanging on to a substrate of being that is going to free us, because hanging on is part of our problem. And it's this analysis of reality that is presented by the Buddha, not as a doctrine or as a dogma, but as simply a description that any one of us who looks carefully at our own experience can affirm in some sense. It is said of the Buddha, "I teach only suffering and the way out of suffering." And you might say, well, what kind of starting point is that for a religious tradition, suffering and the way out of suffering? But I think that challenge is made much more substantial when we acknowledge that this was not the description of simply a few unhappy misfits in the 6th century BCE, but that this analysis of life and its path of liberation formed the basis of a very vibrant and compassionate worldview, a religious tradition that did not create dour, pessimistic cultures, but cultures of tremendous energy and vibrance, Thailand and Burma, China and Japan, a Buddhist teaching that really transformed the face of Asia. We'll return to the teachings the next time, but I want to say a bit more in closing this lecture about the subsequent career of the Buddha. Because again, from his place of enlightenment in Bodh Gaya, he went forth to teach. And he went first to Benares, again to that ancient city on the banks of the Ganges, a busy trading city on the great northern road across North India, where that road crossed the river Ganges. It was fringed with forests and lakes and pools, and it was a perfect place for the ashrams of the gurus and teachers of the day. And the awakened one went to the outskirts of Varanasi, of Benares, to a place called Sarnath today, a rural retreat, and it still has a fairly rural sense about it. And there he found those five companions who had abandoned him, and they were the first ones to whom he spoke of what he had seen. And his first sermon is called The Turning of the Wheel of Dharma, and it is summarized in the Four Noble Truths, which I'll talk about next time. Not only these five former companions of him, but a lot of the prominent citizens of Varanasi came to hear him preach. A community began to form. And for 45 years, the Buddha taught virtually all over North India. He had a long ministry, especially if you compare it to the public ministry of Jesus, for example, which is only about 3 years long. This was 45 years of teaching. He taught largely in the emerging urban centers of North India and spent his rainy season retreats in places that were called viharas, or the sort of monastic retreat centers at the edge of these great cities of Rajagriha and Shravasti and Varanasi. He was not only an urban teacher, but as Trevor Ling, one of his scholars today, you might say, puts it, an urbane man, one who was concerned with a lot of the anxiety, you might say, that accompanied the life of urbanization. So it was not without a touch of irony that the Buddha died, finally, not in one of the great capitals of the country, but in a little insignificant jungle town called Kushinara. In the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which describes his death, the disciple, his beloved disciple Ananda, implores the Buddha, as the Buddha takes sick and seems as if he's about to die. He says to his teacher, "Reverend Sir, let not the Blessed One pass into Nirvana in this little waddle and daub town, this town of the jungle, this little branch village. There are great cities, sir, like Rajagriha and Shravasti and Kosambi and Benares. Let the Blessed One pass into Nirvana in one of them." But there the Buddha died, in Kushinara. In the end, it is said that he gathered his disciples to him and asked them if there were any final questions. And, of course, they couldn't think of any, really. And then he passed away into what is described as that utter passing away of which nothing remains. Of his nirvana, we speak of that awakening, that extinguishing of fuel as taking place at Bodh Gaya. They speak of this utter passing away as his parinirvana. And according to tradition, his last words were these: "So, Ananda, you must be your own lamps, be your own refuges. Take refuge in nothing outside of yourself. Hold fast to truth as a lamp and refuge. Do not look for refuge to anything beside yourself." And so he had his nirvana at Bodh Gaya, his parinirvana at Kushinara, and this man who had walked in complete freedom for 45 years now entered into that final freedom with the words, "Be lamps unto yourselves. No gods, no sacrifices will ferry you across. There will be no rescuer, no Vedas. When it comes to seeing through to wisdom, you finally have to see it for yourself. Nothing else will do." So, if the Buddha is to be called a savior at all, writes a contemporary Theravada Buddhist monk, it is only the sense in which he discovered and showed the path to liberation, or nirvana. But we have to tread that path for ourselves. Now, I might say that in the years following the Buddha's final decease, the question of who is the Buddha for us came up over and over again. And that question has really determined the complexion of the Buddhist tradition throughout Asia. For some, he was the great pathfinder, a human pathfinder. And the reason that he is so compelling a pathfinder is precisely that he was human, so that we can follow that path that he broke through the forest and tangle of this world. We can follow that path on our own lights and attain that which he attained for ourselves. So for many, he was a pathfinder. For others, he became much more than a pathfinder. And the one who had been seen, who had told us that we must be lamps unto ourselves, really became a lamp for others as well. And he came to be seen not only as a pathfinder, but as a being of a magnitude much greater than ourselves. And there came to be doctrines of divine Buddhas who descend into this world as Siddhartha did in his lifetime, as Siddhartha Gautama, and again wake up. And that even amongst us now, there are those who are bodhisattvas, as they say, those who are Buddhas to be, and who eventually, after working in this world with tremendous compassion, will also enter into the realm of Buddhahood. And we'll find, as we explore the teachings of the Buddha, a tremendous emerging diversity of understandings of just who this man, Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha, truly was.